The plane rose and banked over Washington, and the sound of the engines diminished somewhat. The girl was looking out her window. She said, "I love to look at Washington from the air. Such a pretty place." "Want to buy it?" She gave him the sardonic grin he deserved. "You say you get along well with everybody?" "Everybody," Fletch said. "Absolutely everybody. Methodist ministers, uncles, terrific-looking girls sitting next to me on airplanes." "Am I terrific-looking?" she shouted. "Smashing." "You mean smash mirrors kind of smashing?" "I don't know, maybe. How's your husband?" "Don't have one." "Why not?" "Never found anybody good enough to marry me. How's your wife?"
"Which one?"
"You have lots?"
"Have had.
Lots and lots. Gross lots. Practically anybody's good enough to marry me."
"I guess that lets me out," she said.
"I ask people to marry me too quickly," Fletch said. "At least that's what the Methodist minister said."
"And they all say yes?"
"Most have. It's a thing with me. I love the old institutions, like marriage."
"It's a problem?"
"Definitely. Will you help me with it?"
"Of course."
"When I ask you to marry me, please say no."
"Okay."
Fletch looked at his wristwatch and counted off 10 seconds under his breath. "Will you marry me?" he asked.
"Sure."
"What?"
"I said sure."
"Well, you're not much of a help."
"Why should I help you? You get along well with everybody."
"Don't you?"
"No."
"I can see why not. Underneath that terrific exterior, you're weird."
"It's a defense mechanism. I've been working on it."
"Have you ever been in Hendricks, Virginia before?" Fletch asked.
"No."
"Are you going to the AJA convention?"
"Yes."
Fletch thought most, if not all, the people on the plane were. Two seats in front of him was Hi Litwack, anchorman for United Broadcasting Company. Even the back of Hi Litwack's head was recognizable as Hi Litwack.
"Are you a journalist?" Fletch asked.
"You think I'm a busboy?"
"No."
Fletch considered his thumbs in his lap. "I hadn't thought that.
You're a news person."
"With News World Magazine. Women's stuff, fashion, food."
"Crime," she said, looking straight ahead.
"Women's stuff." Fletch was smiling behind his hand.
"Newsperson stuff. I've just come back from covering the Pawtucket trial in Arizona."
Fletch did not know of the case.
"What was the verdict?" he asked.
She said, "Good story."
"Yee."
He slapped himself on the cheek.
"Yee."
She looked into his eyes. "I wouldn't expect any other verdict." "Do you know Walter March was murdered this morning?"
"I heard about it from the taxi radio on the way to the airport. Do you have any of the details?"
"Nary a one."
"Well."
She straightened her legs as much as they could be straightened in the cramped airplane.
"I have 2 notebooks and 3 pens.
Touching her fingers to her lips, she yawned.
"And are you a journalist?"
she asked. "Or a busboy?"
"I'm not sure," he answered. "I'm on a sabbatical."
"From what company?"
"Practically all of them."
"You're unemployed," she said. "Therefore, you're working on a book."
"You've got it."
"On the Vatican?"
"Why the Vatican?"
"You're working on the book in Italy."
"I'm working on a book about Edgar Arthur Tharp, Jr."
"You're working on a book about an American cowboy painter in Italy?" "It brings a certain perspective to the work. Detachment. And I suspect about 30 tons of obstacles."
"Do obstacles come by the ton?"
"In your case, I think so. The rest of us measure them in kilograms." She put her hand on his on the armrest, slipped one of her fingers under 2 of his, raised them, and let them fall.
"I think I detect," she said, "what with all your ex-wives and ex-employers, that your life lacks a certain consistency, a certain glue."
"Rescue me," Fletch said. "Save me from myself."
"What's your name?"
"I am Fletcher."
"Fletcher? Never heard of you. Why so pompous about it?"
"Pompous?
You announced your name, I am Fletcher, as if someone had said you weren't. Why didn't you just say Fletcher?"
She was still playing with his fingers.
"My first initial is I, my second initial is M." she said. An affliction since birth. Does the I stand for Irving? Worse, Irwin. I like the name Irwin. No one likes the name Irwin. You're just prejudiced, she said. I have every reason to be. You have nice hands. One on the end of each arm. With her two hands, she made a loose fist out of his left hand, brought it a few inches closer to her, and dropped it. She was still looking at his hand. Would you run your hands over my naked body time and again? Here, now? Later, she said, later. Oh, I thought you'd never ask. Shall I send them in to you by room service or come myself? Just your hands, she said. I don't know much about the rest of you, except that you get along real well with everybody. He took her hand in his, and she put her left hand on top of his. She had pulled her legs into her seat. Miz, you have me at a disadvantage. I sincerely hope so. I don't know your name. Arbuthnot, she said. Arbuthnot? He extricated his hand. Not Arbuthnot. Arbuthnot, she said. Arbuthnot? Arbuthnot. Frederica Arbuthnot. Freddy Arbuthnot? You've heard of me. Behind that Italian tan, I detect a sudden whiteness of pallor. Heard of you? I made you up. The plane was on its landing run into Hendricks Airport. She truly looked puzzled. I don't get it, she said. Well, I do. Fletch unclasped his seatbelt. He said again, I do. Chapter 4. Mrs. Jake Williams, Helena, she insisted people call her, the hostess at the American Journalism Alliance convention, had a way of greeting people as if they were delighted to see her. Fletcher, darling, aren't you beautiful? She extended both hands beyond her bosom. Hi, Helena, how are you doing? He leaned over her and kissed her. They were standing near the reception desk in the hotel lobby. An airport limousine had been waiting for them when their airplane had touched down. Ignoring his luggage, Fletch had gone directly to the limousine and sat in it. In a few moments, a quiet Frederica Arbuthnot opened the car door and slid in next to him. After the luggage had been stowed on top of the car and most of the other passengers from the airplane had taken seats, they left the airport, went through a small village blighted by a shopping center, and straight out a rolling road to the plantation. Almost immediately outside the village were the plantation's white rail fences on both sides of the road. Fletch lowered his head to look through the windshield as the car turned into the plantation driveway. On both sides of the driveway was a golf course. A brightly dressed foursome was on a green down to the left. The car came to a full stop to let a pale blue golf cart cross the gravel driveway. The plantation house was a mammoth red brick structure behind a white wooden colonnade, with matching red brick additions at both sides and, Fletch supposed, to the rear. They were motel-type units, but well-designed, perfectly in keeping with the main house, the rolling green, the distant white fences. On the last curve before the house, Fletch glimpsed through the side window a corner of a sparkling blue swimming pool. No one had said a word during the ride. The driver's polite question, aimed at the passengers in general, "Did you all have a nice flight?" when he first got into the car, received no answer whatsoever. It was as if they were going to a funeral rather than a convention. Well, they were going to a funeral. Walter March was dead. He had been murdered that morning at Hendricks Plantation. Walter March had been in his 70s. Forever, it seemed, he had been publisher of a large string of powerful newspapers. Probably everyone in the car at one point or another in their careers had had dealings with Walter March. Probably almost everyone at the convention had. These were journalists, some of the best in the business. Smiling to himself, Fletch realized that if any one of them, including himself, had been alone in the car with the driver would have been pumped for every bit of information, speculation, and rumor regarding the murder at his imagination's command. Together, they asked no questions. Unless in an open press conference, where there was no choice, no journalist wants to ask a question whose answer might benefit any other journalist. Fletch waited until his luggage was handed to him from the top of the car, and then went directly into the lobby. While Helena Williams was greeting Fletch, Frederica Arbuthnot, with her luggage, came and stood beside him. She was continuing to look at him quizzically. "Hello, Mrs. Fletcher," Helena said, shaking Freddy's hand. "This isn't Mrs. Fletcher," Fletch said. "Oh, I'm sorry. We're all so used to greeting anyone with Fletch as Mrs. Fletcher. This is Freddy Arbuthnot." Freddy, so many of your girls have had boys' names, Helena said. That girl we met with you in Italy, Andy something or other.
Barbara and Linda, Fletch said. Joan.
There must be something odd about you I've never detected, she said.
There is, said Freddy Arbuthnot.
Furthermore, Helena, Fletch said, Ms. Arbuthnot and I just met on the plane.
That's never been a major consideration before, Helena sniffed.
I remember that time we were all having dinner together in New York, and I noticed you were looking at a girl at the next table, and she was looking at you, and the next thing we knew, you were both gone. You hadn't even excused yourself, not a word. I remember you missed the tarte aux cerises flambé.
I did not.
Well, anyway, Helena said to Freddy, just like everything else Fletch does, he is the most spectacular dues payer. He's coughed up every dime he's owed the American Journalism Alliance, lo, these many years.
She knows, Fletch said.
We were all staggered, Fletch, darling.
I was a little surprised myself, Fletch said. Don't let word get around, okay, Helena? Might ruin my reputation.
Fletch, darling, Helena said with mock sincerity, hand on his forearm. Nothing could do that.
Fletch said, I'm sorry about Walter March, Helena. Helena Williams pushed the mental button for a distraught expression.
The crime of the century, she said.
She'd been married to Jake Williams, managing editor of a New York daily, for more years than anyone who knew Jake could believe.
The crime of the century, Fletch.
Hell of a story, Freddy muttered.
We had a vote this morning, those of us who were here, to decide if we would continue the convention. We decided to open it on time. Well, with all these people coming, what could we do? Everything's arranged. Anyway, the police asked everybody who was here to stay. Having the convention running will help take everybody's mind off this terrible tragedy. Walter March!
She threw her hands in the air.
Who'd believe it?
Is Lydia here, Helena? Fletch asked.
She found the body. She was in the bath, and she heard gurgling. She thought Walter had left the suite. At first she said she thought it was the tub drain, but the gurgling kept up from the bedroom. She got out of the tub and threw a towel around herself. There was Walter, half kneeling, fallen on one of the beds, arms thrown out, a scissors sticking up from his back. While she watched, he rolled sideways off the bed and landed on his back. The scissors must have been driven further in. She said he arched up and then relaxed. All life had gone out of him.
Helena's expression of shock and grief was no longer the result of mental button pushing. She was a lady genuinely struggling to comprehend what had happened and why, and to control herself until she could.
Poor Lydia, she said. She had no idea what to do. She came running down the corridor in her towel and banged on my door. I was just up. This was just before 8 o'clock this morning, mind you. There was Lydia at my door in a towel at the age of 70, her mouth open and her eyes closing. I sat her down on my unmade bed and she fell over. She fainted. I went running to their suite to get Walter. I was in my dressing gown. There was Walter on the floor, spread-eagled, eyes staring straight up. Naturally, I thought he'd had a heart attack or something. I didn't see any blood. Well, I thought I was going to faint. I heard someone shrieking. They tell me it was I who was shrieking.
Helena looked away. Her fingers touched her throat.
I'm not so sure.
Fletch said, Is there anything I can get you, Helena? Anything I can do for you?
No, she said. I had a brandy before breakfast. Quite a sizable dose. And then no breakfast. And then the house doctor here, what's his name, gave me one of those funny pills. My head feels like there's a yellow balloon in it. I've had tea and toast.
She smiled at them.
Enough of this, she said. It won't bring Walter back. Now you must tell me all about yourself, Fletch. Whom are you working for now?
The CIA. He looked openly at Freddy Arbuthnot. I'm here to bug everybody.
You've always had such a delightful sense of humor, Helena said.
He's bugging me, Freddy muttered. I heard that joke, Fletch snapped.
Would you children like to share a room? Helena asked. We are sort of crowded.
Definitely not, Fletch said. I suspect she snores.
I do not.
How do you know?
I've been told.
Well, you're just so beautiful together, Helena said. What is one supposed to think? Oh, here's High Litwack. I didn't see him come in. I must go say hello. Remind him he's giving the after-dinner speech tonight.
Helena episcopally put her hands on Fletch's and Freddy's hands as if she were confirming them, or ordaining them, or marrying them.
We must have life, she said, in the presence of death.
Helena Williams walked away to greet High Litwack.
And death, Fletch said softly, in the presence of life.
Chapter 5. In his room, Fletch, still wet from his shower, sat on the edge of his bed and opened the suitcase he had taken from Locker 719 at Washington's National Airport. Through the wall, he heard Frederica Arbuthnot's hairdryer in the next room. A porter had led them through a door at the side of the lobby, down a few stairs, around a corner, and along the corridor of one of the plantation house's wings. Fletch carried his own bags. The porter stopped at room 77, put down Freddy's luggage, and put the key in the lock. "Where's my room?" Fletch asked. "Right next door, sir, room 79. "Oh, no." Over the porter's shoulder, Freddy grinned at him. "Give me my key," Fletch said. The porter handed it to him. "You know," Fletch said to Freddy, "for someone who's a figment of my imagination, you cling real good." She said, "Your luggage doesn't match." There were four doors to his room, one from the corridor, locked doors to the rooms each side of his, and one leading outdoors. Before he took a shower, he had opened the sliding glass doors. Before him was the swimming pool, sparsely populated by women and children. To the left was a bank of 6 tennis courts, only 2 of which were being used. Every square centimeter of the suitcase's interior was being used. In the center was the tape recorder, with the usual buttons, cigarette pack size speakers each side. It was already loaded with fresh tape. In the pocket of the suitcase lid were 35 more reels of tape, altogether enough for a total of 72 hours of taping. Across the top of the suitcase, over the tape recorder, were 2 bands of stations, each having its own numbered button, each row having 12 stations. To the right was a fine tuner, to the left an on-off volume dial. In a pocket to the left of the tape recorder was a clear plastic bag of nasty-looking little bugs. Fletch shook them onto his bedspread. There were 24 of them, each numbered on its base. Fletch tested one against the bedside lamp and proved to himself the bug's base was magnetic. Below the tape recorder was a deep slot, about a centimeter wide, running almost the length of the suitcase. Toward each end were finger holes. Fletch inserted his index fingers, crooked them as much as space allowed, and pulled up. Perfectly ordinary rabbit ears, telescopic antennae. And in a pocket to the right of the tape recorder were a wire and a plug and an extension cord. Nowhere, not on the tape recorder, nor the tape reels, not even on the suitcase, was a manufacturer's name. Fletch extended the antennae, plugged the machine into a wall socket, turned it on, chose bug number 8, put it against the bedside lamp, pressed the button for station number 8, pushed the record button, and said the following. "Attention, Eggers, Gordon, and Fabens, Richard." The red volume level needle was jumping at the sound of his voice. The machine was working. Fletch turned the volume dial a little counterclockwise. "This is your friend, Irwin Maurice Fletcher, talking to you from the beautiful Hendricks Plantation in Hendricks, Virginia, U.S. of A. It's not my practice, of course, to accept press junkets, but, seeing your insistence I take this particular trip was totally irresistible, I want to tell you how grateful I am to you for not sending me anyplace slummy." Fletch released the record button, pushed the rewind and play buttons. His own voice was so loud it made him jump to turn the volume dial for counterclockwise, a very sensitive instrument. He listened through what he had said so far. Chuckling to himself, Fletch turned the machine off and padded in his towel to the bathroom for a glass of water before sitting on the edge of his bed and pushing the record button again. "Obviously," he said to the room at large, "I could fill up 72 hours of tape with jokes, stories, songs, and tap dancing, but if I understand correctly, that is not why I'm here. In the event of my death or whatever, I want anyone who discovers this formidable machine in my room to understand what it is doing here and what I am doing here. I am being blackmailed by the Central Intelligence Agency, under threat of spending 20 years or more in prison for failing to file federal income tax returns, illegally exporting money from the United States, plus not being able to account for the source of money in the first place, to bug and record the private conversations of my colleagues at the American Journalism Alliance Convention at Hendricks Plantation. Who'd ever think having a fortune could be so much trouble? My 3 reasons for going along with this, quote, assignment, unquote, are obvious to any journalist. To Eggers Gordon, Fabens Richard, Gibbs Don, Englehart Robert, and all you other backwards people whose asses are where your mouths are supposed to be, so far I have the following to tell you. First, I suspect you all suck goat's cocks and lay hens. Second, the person you are most interested in having me bug, old Walter March, is dead, so there. Which, of course, causes me to wonder if the reason for your interest in him and the reason for his murder have anything in common. Third, Frederica Arbuthnot has done a terrific job of clinging to me so far. She is magnificently seductive. However, you guys have to be some kind of special stupid. What you've done is like sending a man into battle with an arrow through his head. More jokes and stories later. I'll try to learn all the verses of The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald to sing to you at bedtime. Fletch turned the machine off and sat another moment, hands in lap, looking at it. Then he put the suitcase on the floor, leaving it open, and slid it under the bed with his toe. Kneeling, he forced the antennae under the box spring. He lay on his stomach on the floor, unplugged the machine, and shoved all the wire under the bed so none of it would be visible from anywhere in the room, and replugged it, running the wire between the bed's headboard and the wall. Wriggling out from under the bed, his left biceps landed on paper, an envelope. Sitting cross-legged on the floor, he picked up the envelope. He was sure it had not been there before. It must have fallen out of the suitcase. It had not been sealed. Dear Mr. Fletcher, our representatives in Italy, in explaining your assignment to you, mentioned only the name of Mr. Walter March. As you have now seen, the equipment we provided you has 24 listening devices and stations. We would like to have our public relations effort directed specifically at those on the following list. You may disperse the remainder of the listening devices in the quarters of those younger journalists you feel are most apt to rise to positions of power and influence, in time. We will not consider this assignment completed unless all the devices have been used profitably. Next to each name on the list was the journalist's network, wire service, newspaper, or magazine affiliation. They were all so well known there was absolutely no need to list their affiliations. On the list were Mr. and Mrs. Walter March, Walter March Jr., Leona Hatch, Robert McConnell, Raleigh Wisham, Louis Graham, Hi Litwack, Sheldon Levy, Mr. and Mrs. Jake Williams, Nettie Horn, Frank Gillis, Tom Lockhart, Richard Baldridge, Stuart Poynton, Eleanor Earls, and Oscar Perlman. Sons of bitches, Fletch said. Sons of bitches. There was no signature, of course, just the words in tiny print at the very bottom of the letter. We use recycled paper. Chapter 6. Fletch picked up the ringing telephone and said, "Thank you for calling. Is this Ronald Albemarle Blodgett Islington Dimwitty Fletcher?" a woman's voice asked. "Why, no," Fletch answered. "It isn't." Who would be calling him Rabid? He remembered vaguely an old joke someone had once told about Fletch biting a dog on a slow news night. Who else? "Crystal," he said. "My pal, my ass, how the hell are you?" Giggling, per usual, in her throat, per usual, sardonically silly old Crystal. "Are you there?" he asked. "Has the Crystal Palace shivered and shimmied into my very own purview?" She began to sing the words, "All of me." He joined in halfway through the first bar. "Still heavily concerned with your tonnage, eh, old girl? Still down in the chins?" Crystal Faoni was not pellucid. She, too, had been cursed by her parents when it had come time to delete Baby Girl Faoni from her birth register and substitute something more specific. Crystal was dark, with black hair, which could have been straight, or could have been curly, but wasn't either. Blessedly, basically heavy, with monumental bones, each demanding its kilogram of flesh. The appetite of a bear just after the first snowfall. She also had huge, wide-set brown eyes, the world's most gorgeous skin, and a mind so sprightly and entertaining, apparently it had never felt the need to cause her body to do anything but the sedentary. She and Fletch had worked together on a newspaper in Chicago. "Are you well?" he asked. "I thought we could meet in the bar before the welcoming cocktail party and have too much to drink." "I plan to go sit in the sauna and have a rub." Skimming the hotel's brochure on the bedside table, Fletch had noticed there were an exercise room, a sauna, and a massage room open from 10 to 7. "Oh, Fletch," she said, "why do you always have to do such healthy things?" "I've been on airplanes and in airports the last 24 hours. I'm stiff." "You've already had too much to drink? You don't sound it." "Not that way. Are you still working in Chicago?" "Why," she asked rhetorically, "do people go to conventions?" "To wear funny hats and blow raspberry noisemakers?" "No." "I don't know, Crystal. I've never been to a convention before." "Why are you here? I am Fletcher." "Lord love a duck," he said to himself. Everyone who knew him would know that convention going was not his thing. Neither was dues paying. He said, "Let me guess. You're unemployed, right?" "Between jobs." "Right. Let's return to our original question. Why do people go to conventions? To get jobs? About half. Either to get jobs if they're unemployed or to get better jobs if they are employed.
Yes.
About a third of the people at conventions are looking for people to hire. A convention, dear Mr. Fletcher, as you well know, is one great meat market. And as I don't need to remind you, I am one great piece of meat. If memory serves, you do help fill up a room. It is not possible to overlook me. What about the other 16.7%? What? You said half the people are here to get jobs and a third are here to give jobs. That leaves 16.7%.
Almost. What are they doing here?
Oh, those are the people who drop anything they're doing, including nothing at any time, and go anywhere for any reason at someone else's expense, preferably their company's.
Gotcha.
Except for poor little Crystal Fayoni, who is here, as I expect you are, by the grace of a rapidly dwindling savings account.
Crystal, how did you know I'm unemployed?
Because if you were employed, you'd be working on a story somewhere, and no one could divert you to attend a convention even under threat of execution, about right?
Now, Crystal, you know I always do what I'm told.
Remember that time they found you asleep under the serving counter in the paper's cafeteria?
I had worked late.
But, Fletch, you weren't alone. One of the all-night telephone operators was with you.
So what?
At least you had your jeans on, all zipped up nicely. That was all you were wearing.
We'd fallen asleep.
I guess Jack Saunders was absolutely purple. The cafeteria staff refused to work that day.
People get upset over the most trivial things.
My missing lunch, Fletcher, is not a trivial thing. If you'd been working for old man March at that point, you would have been fired before you reached for your shirt.
You worked on a March newspaper, didn't you?
In Denver, and I was fired from it on moral grounds.
Moral grounds? You?
Me.
What'd you do, overdose on banana splits?
You know all about it. I do not. Everyone knows all about it.
I don't.
No, I suppose you don't. I don't suppose anyone would bother to pass on such a juicy piece of moral scandal to you. You're the source of so many such scandals yourself. You just say ho-hum and gun your motorcycle.
Ho-hum, Fletch said.
You know, instead of being on the telephone all this time, we could be curled up in a dark corner of the bar tossing down mint juleps or whatever the poison of the house is.
Are you going to tell me?
I was pregnant.
How could anyone tell?
Pardon me while I chuckle.
Were you married?
Of course not.
So why was that Walter March's business?
I didn't act contrite enough. I told people I intended to have the baby and keep it. That was back in those days, remember? We all thought things had changed.
Yeah.
I'd gotten pregnant on purpose, of course. An absolutely great guy, Phil Shapiro, remember him?
No.
An absolutely great guy, good-looking, brainy, happily married.
So what happened to the kid, the baby?
I thought I could handle having a baby without being married, but I sure couldn't handle having a baby without being either married or employed.
Abortion?
Yeah.
Shit.
That's what happened to my savings account the last time it got over $2,000.
Great old Walter March.
He fired a great many people on moral grounds.